You are listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. Today, on this special Show Me the Money edition of Richmond's Audio News Digest, we'll explore all aspects of the TEDx RVA event happening next week, including an interview with head organizer Andy Stefanovich. We'll also present part two in our series on the state of public art funding in Richmond. We'll talk with City Deputy Director Doug Dunlop and First District City Councilman John Belon. Here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
Open up your eyes. Look around you, can't you see, baby, we ain't got nowhere.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Earlier this week, Mayor Dwight Jones unveiled his administration's two-year budget as well as a five-year capital improvement plan. The biennial fiscal plan will go into action on July 1st of this year, which marks the beginning of Virginia fiscal year 2014, and cover the next 2 years until June 30th, 2015. On the mayoral blog at richmondvamayor.blogspot.com, Jones's press secretary touts the proposed 2% pay increase for city workers, as well as the change in the city's water rate structure, which has been a hot issue this year. Richmond City's base rate for water is currently $49.40, the highest in the nation, and the new budget lowers the rate to $26.11. Also, according to this plan, residents and businesses will no longer get a break for using large amounts of water. City Council has outlined their schedule for discussing and settling the budget on their blog at richmondvacitycouncil.blogspot.com. The first public hearing on the budget, where citizens may voice their opinions on their city's financial plan, is scheduled for the Monday, April 8th City Council meeting. For further coverage and analysis of the budget, be sure to tune in to us at Open Source and follow our website at rvaopensource.com. A bill that aims to hand back options to cell phone users nationwide has been introduced by House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte, a Virginia Republican from Roanoke County. The Unlocking Consumer Choice and Wireless Competition Act would again allow cell phone customers to unlock their devices once their contracts are fulfilled, so they could then switch from one wireless carrier to another. A mobile phone exemption in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was allowed to expire on January 26th, which means that no customer who has since bought a cell phone may switch service providers on their device, even when their contract is over. Goodlatte's bill means to bring back the exemption, as well as to ask the Copyright Office whether similar exemptions should apply to other devices. The bill is co-sponsored by Senior Judiciary Committee Democrat John Conyers and supported by members of the Court's Intellectual Property and the Internet Subcommittee. Companion legislation was introduced in the Senate earlier this week. Local bar and restaurant Couscous announced today on their Facebook page that they will be shutting their doors for good come Saturday, March 30th. No reason was given for the seemingly abrupt closing, though Couscous and staff did thank and broadcast their eternal love for their customers for all the good times over the past 7 years. Mother State Roller Derby rolls into its fourth season this Saturday, March 16th, at Skateland of Virginia. The women of Mother State will face off with the Blue Ridge Roller Girls, French broads who hail from the exotic land of Asheville, North Carolina. Besides the thrill of the game, fans can bid on raffle items to support the team or check out yoga demos by the folks of Project Yoga Richmond. All one has to do to get in is bring a canned food item for Feed More, the Central Virginia Food Bank. The 2013 season kickoff showdown goes down at 3 p.m. this Saturday at Skateland of Richmond, located at 5512 Hull Street.
I'm tired of listening to your What's the big idea? Richmond finds out next Friday as TEDx RVA brings its inspirational brand of Speechify into town. TED, short for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, has been around for more than two decades, a national forum for leading-edge thinkers to present their latest and greatest. But TED truly blossomed in the internet age, with many TED presentations becoming YouTube phenomenon on par with honey badgers and that cat that gets stuck to the spinning ceiling fan. Richmond's TED event, with the minimal theme of create, is billed as an opportunity for an idea exchange, Richmond ideas mingling with some of the brightest minds on the national creative stage. And its organizers have pulled the whole thing together in record time. It's also been subject to its share of controversy, inspiring a parallel and ultimately productive conversation among young creatives and among the city's Black leadership. WRIR and Open Source, it should be noted, are proud to be a part of the event, blogging with a rotating slate of celebrity co-bloggers, city leaders, provocative thinkers, radicals, fellow journalists from other city media outlets, and even a couple of those critics of the TED movement. Today we present, though, conversations with the head curator of TEDx RVA, Andy Stefanovich, and with one local TED presenter, Zoe Romano. We also hear from Mark Cheatham and Duran Chavis, community leaders whose initial frustration with TED has given way to positive action. I'm with Andy Stefanovich. He is the curator of TEDx RVA, which of course is the hopefully first annual, right, Andy?
Absolutely. Working hard to make it an annual.
Excellent. All right. First of all, this is it's a huge undertaking. It's probably the most amazing thing to me about this thing is the timeline, first of all, of when this was announced and when we started going out to, and this is your job, curate who's going to be there, and when the event is actually happening.
Yeah. I think a whole host of things make it a crazy mixed bag of how do you produce something like this in the timeline? But I think the first thing is the community rose up. I mean, it's amazing. We have over 100 volunteers working on it literally hourly through their day-to-day jobs and their paying jobs as volunteers. And it's really to bring what they know is an important project to Richmond. And it's the TED-obsessed fan. I don't even know about it, but I know it's a good thing for Richmond fan and their new fan. And really, I mean, it's an amazing mix of people. It's pharmaceutical salespeople, it's hourly workers, it's teachers, it's executives, it's nonprofit, it's profit. It is all the way across the board. And it's just been really an amazing observation to watch the community rise up. I think the other thing that adds to some of the complexity, which will hopefully chalk up this first year learning curve, is all the TED ask of a project like this, and it's all very fair and really required in terms of standing or withholding the standards and the reputation of the brand, and really kind of doing what they want to do with it. No sponsors on the stage, and making sure that it's really purely about ideas that are worth sharing, and putting people on the stage in a very pure, kind of clean, kind of unbiased way. And then the other part of it, I think, is the fact that we just didn't go to a normal theater like we could have and had a red carpet on the stage. And all that goes with that is an enormous undertaking in its own right. But we bit off a whole lot more in the filling into a raw
you
warehouse.
You bit off a massive amount. And that was actually the next thing I wanted to ask you about is why did you choose that space? This is, like you said, it's a raw vacant space that is really bare walls, bare floor. It's a little echoey.
Yeah. I just got pictures. They clean the walls and they clean the floor and they're painting a few of the little areas of the space. But really, the vision was really bring to bear a part of town that really needs to be recognized, and that's really downtown proper, and showing that so much of the creative energy and so much of the creative dynamism comes from the core of downtown Richmond. And then the other is to, I think, and we're really finding this to be true, is to create a place almost like our finest spot that could be our canvas that we could create. Just like the theme is create, we thought, why not allow us to go through the process of creating a space from ground up, and where it's been an enormous undertaking, I think the rewards are going to be not only for the team working on it really, really beautiful, like an artist filling a canvas, but also the attendees and the people that then see it subsequently online will see that it's very different, unique, and clever, and it's got a ton of experiences built into it, unlike a traditional spot. So
right.
I think part of community building, and also we wanted to embody the idea of create.
This place building, I guess, right? Kind of place building.
What's that?
I say place building. Building the place. Building the place itself. Place building.
It is place building. Meaning making, place building, the whole gamut. Absolutely. I think, you know, it's gained some good awareness for the building, which, well, we're looking at it for a host of other reasons for the city. And so, you know, it's a good thing. It's turned out really great. Although it's been tiring, it's been great.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the speakers we're going to see? And I guess we can talk, too, a little bit about, there was a tad bit of controversy over some of the selection of those folks. But first, tell me about how you came to bring some of the people to Richmond who are coming. And it really is a pretty exciting slate of folks.
It's an amazing group. And I think our early on vision was to have really kind of generally half of the content on the stage, or half of the talks from the local region, and then half of the talks on the stage not from the region. And it was my vision for that early on, and the fact that I wanted to highlight all that is so beautiful and amazing in Richmond, and not all of it for sure, because you could only get so much on the stage in one day.
Sure.
But then the other half of it would be to have great creators from outside of the region to come in and inspire us, and for us to get context and just get tangential perspectives that then we can apply to our region here in Richmond. And that it's played out just great. We have, So, I mean, I think the half and half has really kind of worked out. It's going to be half of the people we know and really believe that should be on the stage for the first inaugural. And then there are many more that we couldn't get on the list, and we've been inundated with the requests, which is just a great thing, because we'll be able to apply all that knowledge and all that insight into the subsequent years.
Now, I know you can't pick one, but I'm going to ask you to pick one. Is there one in particular that you're very excited to have on that stage?
No, I think, you know, it's a tough one, because I'm really biased to all of them for different reasons. But I think, you know, I'll just pick on Ben Margolis, who's a great entrepreneur, young man here in Richmond, has a store in Tarrytown called West Coast Kicks.
Right.
And he is just a genuinely great young man. And he was an investment banker and then said, I want to change the perceptions and the stigma of a category, that being kind of sneakers and cool clothes for hipsters and for kind of the younger crowd. And he said it doesn't need to be about a stigma and about being too cool for school. It needs to be about being nice and being kind. And so his perspective around creating a different retail experience is just a lovely example of how we as Richmonders say we can break the mold and do things a little bit different and create our own narrative. And he's a great example of someone that we every day get to enjoy by virtue of his retail store interactions with him. And we as a committee really thought he would be really one very good example of showing how Richmond creates every day. And it's been lovely working with people like that. They've never had this exposure. This will be a new experience for them. And it's really been great. So Ben's a great example. And then on the other side of the coin, you know, I think a great example of kind of the outside perspective that we're bringing in is two gentlemen named David and Krister from a university in Aarhus, Denmark, and they are coaches at a very, very interesting entrepreneurial social innovation school in Denmark.
Yep.
And they're going to come over and talk about how they see CREATE, so a different nationality, from an educational and pedagogical perspective, and they're very disruptive. And so that real narrative difference from Ben on Cherry Street to the Chaos Pilot from Denmark is, I think, an example of the swing of the type of people we have on the stage that day.
Well, and of course, Denmark is a place that we look at a lot right now with our own national debate over education, and what you're bringing in is somebody who, or two somebodies, who really are on the vanguard even of that in their own country, which we consider to be sort of a leading edge. So that should be very interesting.
Yeah, and the hope is, you know, you hear David and Christopher talking, is we as a region look at education, we as a region look at social innovation and just innovation generally. You know, David and Christopher, from that culture and their perspective from an education standpoint, will offer something. And the hope is for us to say, you know, we heard those two gentlemen say something. And so what that makes us think about as a community is, and may just take us somewhere, maybe a new format or a new startup or a new nonprofit or a new community project. That's the hope of having this outside stimulation.
Now, you are a TEDx vet, right?
I've been going to TED, the conference in Long Beach, for about, I'd say I'm on my seventh or eighth year, yeah.
But you have all...
I've spoken, I think, around five or six TEDx's, from NASA, the London Business School, to our very own local James River High School TEDx, which was held a couple years ago. Which was just great. So, yeah, I've been around the scene for quite a bit.
So tell me, what's your experience as a TEDx speaker? Is this a difficult thing to put together? Is this a pretty simple, just, hey, I'm just going to give my pitch, elevator pitch? Is it a, how difficult is it?
To give a TED Talk?
Yeah, what do you bring to it when you're thinking of what you're going to be trying to convey, to present to folks? How do you give something that's, you know, more than just a speech? Because at the end of the day, these are just speeches.
That's a great question. I think the difference between a speech and a talk is a speech is at and a talk is with. And, you know, TED is about bringing ideas that are worth sharing to the stage. And it's the hope to, one, be authentic and genuine and just share a story that the world ought to hear more about in order to make the world a better world or make the community a better community in this case. And the other part of it is to be, you know, have a strong conviction and share a belief system that you think is important for the world to have. And you know, at the end, debate a bit and have some good conversation around it. It's fiery and fierce and kind of sometimes not polite, because that's the nature of a good, strong point of view. It creates and stimulates conversation, which will lead us to a better place. I think if we all have an appreciative perspective and see all the things that TED Talks bring to us, there's always something we can take from them. And you may not agree with the perspective, but you can also learn, or at the minimum, just gain context you might have not had otherwise. And so I think the preparation is important, to have a strong belief, bring it with conviction, and be genuine and honest about your belief system. And I think that everyone in the audience, live or online, can always take something from that.
Now, and this was bound to happen with a big event or an event like this that everybody wants to be a part of. You've hit up against some controversy. Later in the show, we're going to have Mark Cheatham, who's the Cheats Movement, and Duron Chavis, who's Brother Manifest and a well-known urban agriculture guy here in Richmond, who also does Happily Natural Day, founder of that. And they had a couple of little problems with how this program has kind of unfolded, anything from the cost, the kind of the perceived exclusivity of some of it to, you know, who are we including in the speakers. But you've been in contact with them, and there's been something of a meeting of the minds, right?
It's anything that has strong impact and an emotional kind of quotient like TED, or putting people on a stage and all of that comes with that, I think there's always going to be really good, fiery conversation. Duron and Mark and I and all of several others had a 3-hour conversation recently, and it was all about really understanding that we're all in the same belief system, that the community is first, that some of the, I think you used the perfect word, perceived exclusivity was not really exclusivity. It was all about bringing the most diversified an eclectic audience to the mix. And the only reason we had people fill out a dossier was to assure that we did have a diverse audience in the mix, not to exclude, but to make sure we're including everyone. And we actually did get to take everyone that submitted first and the first come, first serve, because the audience was so diverse and so mixed in terms of occupation, demographic, social mix, ethnicity, and otherwise. So I think when you have an enormously strong emotional kind of attention to community building, like all of us that are mentioned, you're going to have different perspectives. But when you bring something into town like TED that has such a strong affinity and a strong brand, that you've got a potent mix of a lot of things that people can have reactions to. The good thing is whenever you sit down and talk about it, you always find that you're pretty much on the same place and same plane and want the same thing. So that's the good thing. And it's really... And this is a work in progress. We as a community get to build up and we've agreed that after this event, we'll have a series of dinner parties to have more people that want to come to the table. We have been as inclusive as we humanly possibly could in terms of simulcast around the region, literally tearing a wall down in the building in order to accommodate more people, scholarship, and otherwise. It's always a learning curve, but I think the team has done a yeoman job in terms of accommodating as many voices into the conversation as possible. But we're not done. I mean, it's about the first year and about doing better the second year, so we'll continue to do that.
And I'm sure it's going to be an amazing program going forward. Here with Andy Stefanovich, who is the organizer of, or I guess the curator, the head curator of TEDx RVA, which is coming to Richmond here next week. I'm here with Zoe Romano. She, a couple of years ago, when did you do this? You ran across the country for Boys and Girls Club.
2011.
Yes. And you're really, in real life, I guess, a Spanish tutor and a freelance writer. Attended University of Richmond and ended up, like so many University of Richmond graduates from elsewhere, in your case, Maine, ended up stuck here. And now you're going to be speaking at TEDx.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're talking about?
Sure. So I'll be talking kind of about my run across the country, as well as my plans for the summer, which are really exciting. I don't know if I can release them.
Are you running somewhere?
I'm running the route of the Tour de France.
Oh, wow.
So it's
a lot of uphill, isn't it?
It's a lot of uphill. It's I read that it's about 3.5 Everest worth of elevation change. So it'll be a lot of climbing, yes.
So you're right now training, what, on a treadmill that's basically on like a 45-degree incline? Or?
I hate the treadmill. So I'm training on the trails here in Richmond, and then every week or whenever I can get out to the mountains out in Shenandoah. I mean, occasionally, yeah, I go on the treadmill and just pump that baby up to 10%.
And hope you don't fall. And
yeah, exactly. Hope I don't run myself off of the treadmill.
So how are you going to be, other than the fact that you're doing something insane, how are you going to be inspiring us at TEDx?
Just, I guess, carrying the message of what goes into the creative process and what has to happen between having an idea like running across the country and the execution of running across the country, and all the parts that are important. Not just, you look at someone that runs across the country and all you see is that they ran 30 miles a day for 4 months and that they're insane and that you can never do that. But the point is that you can do that, and there are certain qualities and things you need to do beforehand. It'll be uncertain, you need focus and determination, and just, so sort of talking about the specific parts that need to go into creating anything truly unique or doing anything that in retrospect feels and is extraordinary, I think.
How did you get picked to speak, and what are you feeling right now, I guess, in the last week before you're giving this speech? And it's a fairly short one, I understand, four minutes,
yes. I'm a little nervous. I've been practicing a lot. What I do is record myself speaking and then listen to it while I'm running. And since I run so much, I have a lot of time to do that. But basically, I pitched my story, and a couple of the organizers, I think, had heard the story about the Tour de France plans. And so I pitched the story and just kind of said how I thought that related to the theme of creating and why it's necessary to hear what I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then just went from there.
And there you are. You're on the stage. You're
yeah.
Average everyday Richmonder about to maybe have a shot at big-time TED fame, I guess.
Oh, gosh. I don't know about that.
So have they helped you to prepare your speech, or is it just a lot of miles that you're putting in?
I mean, I draft the speech, go over it, pick the images, and then meet with kind of a speaking coach who just says, this is what you're saying, this is what I'm hearing. Is this what you want me to hear? Is this what you want me to take away? And then go back to the drawing board, record another version, hit the trails, listen to it again, and kind of rework it. So it's a work in progress. It's not, I don't know how other speakers are, but for me, I can't go up there and say something verbatim. So it's just kind of knowing what your messages are, but being natural at the same time.
What's harder, running uphill or speechifying?
Speechifying. But the both together, it's quite hard.
Well, lucky you're not going to be running while you're speechifying, right?
Exactly.
All right. And I've been with Zoe Romano. She is going to be one of our TEDx RVA speakers.
Yes.
This Woo-hoo. Coming Friday. Good luck.
Thank you.
I am with Mark Cheatham. He's the Cheats Movement website, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that is in a minute. and how what part it's played, I suppose, in some of the TEDx conversation outside of TEDx RVA. And Duron Chavis, aka Brother Manifest, he's the founder of Happily Natural, as well as an urban agriculture advocate. Thank you guys for being here today.
Word. Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us, man.
And this has been, I guess, first of all, let's just start at the beginning. You heard that TEDx RVA was coming, and it sounded like, from some of the conversations I've had with you, you guys were somewhat enthusiastic about it when the announcement first came. Be fair?
Yeah, it is fair. I mean, when I first heard about it, I was hyped, you know, to be honest. My hypeness was kind of checked by a colleague, though, a friend of mine, had told me about a young lady from out of the Bronx who had been invited to TEDx but then got disinvited because of her political stance on class and race as it related to the food justice movement.
And this is the TEDx Manhattan.
The TEDx Manhattan. The young lady that I'm referring to, her name is Tanya Fields. Real dope sister doing awesome work around guerrilla gardening and things like that. And the question of whether or not she could speak at TEDx Manhattan was risen by the organizers of that program. They first invited her, then they said, well, no, you don't have nonprofit status, so you can't speak. And it was a real issue. I mean, the question of whether or not she could speak, really at the root of it, was about what she was going to talk about. You know, she was going to be talking about, you know, how race intersects with the food justice movement, lack of people of color in the movement, or lack of people of color at the table when it comes to, you know, food equity and making sure people have access, these programs and nonprofits, things like that. So when I heard about that, I immediately reflected back to what's going on in Richmond. I said, dag, you know, I'm a part of a lot of different conversations at the same time, things like the Capital Region Collaborative, Leadership Metro Richmond, things like that. And one of the things I've often seen is that, A, it's lack of black people at the table, and then the other piece is there's lack of black people that are of a specific demographic or worldview at the table. So it's kind of hard for this inclusion to really, that people are advocating and saying that is really a part of the greater scheme of what's going on, to really be there. Nobody really sees anybody that's talking about left ideologies or activism, especially when it comes from people of color. So when I first started speaking on that on Facebook, like, the response was tremendous. I mean, it was so many people from wide array of different communities.
And just to talk about that real quick, there was quite a lot of that, not just that conversational thread, but there was I don't know what to call them. Maybe I guess the alternative creative
right.
crowd in Richmond,
right.
who's sort of a younger generation,
yeah.
black and white,
right, exactly.
Urban and suburban,
mm-hmm,
who
mm-hmm.
had a rather spirited conversation around this thing as well, right. sort of saying, hey, we have some issues with.
Yeah, and so I mean, for me, you know, at first I was hype. I was like, yo, man, TEDx is awesome. I mean, I've been a fan of the talks for a long time, you know, particularly because of the power of ideas to change people's reality. I mean, ideas that when they become manifest, you know, that's a tangible situation that we can all take up a role in making our realities change. You know, somebody put the idea out there, hey, let's go ahead and make it happen. So I've been inspired by some of these TED Talks for a while, but then the question of whether or not it was hitting in Richmond, I was like, oh man, I would love to see such person from Richmond speak, or at least somebody in Richmond to speak to some of the issues that Richmond has. And, you know, when I started to think about, well, how does racism and classism intersect in Richmond, I was like, man, the chances of really powerful presentations coming from people of color or coming from people who have been marginalized from these conversations, it probably won't happen. I'm an optimist at best, but just given the way that Richmond politics usually go down with all these master plans and things like that, even with talking about housing, medical, things like that, it's usually nobody of color there. And it's usually a bunch of white folks that got money at the table. They make the decision, and then they hope everybody else is ready to go along with the get along.
So, Cheats, now your side.
I would say, and I would say I take it from a little bit of a different angle, in the sense of I have been, probably for since I started the blog, this is going on the third year, I have been and continue to be really excited about what's going on in the city and what's going on in the community. And I took a little bit of a different approach to TEDx. because I just saw it as another vehicle of all of these exciting things that were happening in the city. Mm-hmm. So, there was a lot of positive energy, and there is a lot of positive energy and a lot of really good things going on in the city and the community. And when TEDx was announced and it started to build up, it was a really, really exciting time because it was kind of just another thing that was piled on to some of these really great things that were going in the city. And so that's where my excitement came from. It really didn't come from, oh, TEDx is coming, I'm going to get excited about TEDx. I continue to be excited about what's happening in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this as a vehicle that would spend even another national spotlight on the city. And I still think that there's been some really good dialogue, maybe kind of in a roundabout way about kind of execution and things like that. But I am very encouraged. I'm actually more encouraged today about kind of how everything took place and the dialogue that's come out of everything that's took place than I was before I heard, oh, well, TEDx is coming.
And what seems to be positive out of this, and maybe some of this makes it sound like it's been a negative, but what's been positive about it is it has spurned some conversations, some very intense, and sometimes some very intense conversations, but also some really positive conversations with, I guess, you guys and the organizers, and then just sort of in the community. I really would like you to tell me a little bit about sort of what you've done with your website, the Cheats Movement.
Sure, and it really was, I keep saying was, but it really is an ongoing. We're kind of in the middle of this, or even at the very beginning of kind of what has gotten people like Duran and myself and everyone excited and talking. This is just the start kind of what's. We hope is going to be a long dialogue of things. And what really kind of sparked it for me, and it really, I got to say, it really did start before I even heard of TEDx. At the beginning of the year, I tell you, WIR played a much bigger role in all of this for me than TEDx was, because there were things that I'd seen kind of through our site. And one of the things about the site has always been kind of a community pro culture, but it's also been very heavy into diversity and integration and bringing different pockets of people together.
Right.
And one of the things that we did at WRR was, we brought together another type of, like a little bit of hip hop culture to mix in with. Every year they do it in a great way, but we did it under the kind of the Cheats Movement blog umbrella of bringing in a different people that people would never see and interact with. And that really, I think, a couple days after the that show, that really just brought a whole bunch of diverse Richmond culture together in one place.
And that was on which show here?
This was actually the, it was the annual party for the rest of us.
Okay.
Really exciting. But to make a long story short, after that, I think maybe 2 or 3 days after that, it came clear to me that, hey, look, I'm going to use this blog platform to make the city smaller, to bring all of these different groups together. And so what happened and what continues to happen is, and Duran kind of alluded to it as well, very often these major conversations really happen in silos. Mm-hmm. And I made that very clear on my blog that I was like, when people talk about community, and Richmond does it a lot, I think it's pretty much every 2 or 3 or 4 years, there's this wave of, hey, we're going to improve Richmond, and we're going to talk about community, and we're going to get all these things going.
Right.
Well, what we've noticed is...
We do a lot of speeches.
And what we've noticed is all of Richmond, well, in my opinion, and some of my friends as well, we've never seen a really good rainbow of Richmond, really good all-Richmond type representing these conversations.
And that's what you've done on your blog.
And that's what we've done on the blog. And I'll tell you, I don't know if it could have happened 4 years ago, Chris, to be honest with you, because
I don't know if it could have happened 3 months ago.
Well, the tool of social media is very powerful.
Yeah.
And the fact that what we did on the blog, and this is after we saw kind of a promo-type community discussion that was on Richmond Grid and a good... a really good supporter of everything that's going on is Paul Spicer.
Yeah. Richmond Grid.
Right, but I think it's owned by Venture Richmond, and it's one of those things where they're...
Paul owns it now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. But
hey, Paul.
The group, and Paul, like I said, we got to be very clear that Paul's been a really encouraging advocate for everything that's happened. But what we saw was kind of a group of conversation, again, about community that really didn't represent all of Richmond. And after we saw that, and a couple of my friends had a discussion about it. I said on the site, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to open it up to everyone that reads my site, mm-hmm. and we're going to do a week long about what community means to them.
Mm-hmm. But it hasn't just been everybody that reads your site. It has gone. It's gone.
Chris, they all read my site. Well,
yeah, some of these people. Who doesn't read the Chiefs?
It reads the site. You're right. You're right. We have been extremely lucky that all of Richmond, and when I say all of Richmond, it's only been about 45 or 50 posts, but they represent either the business
and
community.
And that is
the
what's so cool about it. When I look at it, I mean, the names that you see on there are people you would never expect to see all collected in one place.
Sure.
You asked one question, basically, right?
Yeah.
Is the way you did it. What is the question?
The question was, what does community mean to you?
Mm. And from there, you ended up with, so far, about 45 posts?
About 45 in a week, and we cut it off.
From everybody from?
For everyone from Jim Ucrop to Delegate Jim McCullen to Brother Manifest here to Mahat Free to Swordplay, an underground hip hop artist that were, you know,
to the What's Her Nose with the Mom blog. I saw her on there.
To Kate Hall, RichmondMom.com, to Black Liquid of the New Juice Crew. Yeah. I mean, it really was an outpouring, but that's the thing.
To everyday people as well. Let's
absolutely. But this is the thing that we're talking about. People want to have these conversations,
yeah.
and they want to have them about this city because they're excited about what's going on. I think people, really, in 2013, I think people feel that, hey, there may be something different this time.
The
key here is making sure that everyone, people from the top end to the bottom and the bottom end to the top end, play a part in that. And that was the thing about TEDx. We want to make sure that everyone in Richmond has a part of the. We think it's a great thing, but we also want it to be great in Mosby Court, as great as it is on Carey Street. So we want to make sure that everyone is represented in the play field.
And real quick, just to let the listener know, we're going to be at RIR here. We're blogging from the event, and we're kind of curating a discussion during the event as well that is going to be a part of, or at least loosely associated with the event. And Brother Manifest is going to be joining us, and hopefully,
we're both attending. That's one of the things it's really funny when you said that some of the dialogue has been steered to giving a hint of. This can't work or something like that, but we're both going. Yeah. We're excited about going, and that's the thing. We want to make sure that people, you know, I don't speak for everyone, but we want to make sure that people that may not have, you know, might not be a giant Capital One investor or a Martin Agency investor can go, and hopefully we'll be able, and WRR as well, can report things to some of those people that may not have been able to get in on our sites to say, hey, look, this is what's happening. We hope we can get you, you know, involved next time and get you excited about it.
All right. And I hate to cut this conversation off, but we're gonna hopefully continue this conversation. And again, I've been with Mark Cheatham. He's with the Cheats Movement website, which everybody should go take a look at because you might find your community there. And Duran Chavis, a.k.a. Brother Manifest, founder of Happily Natural and urban agricultural advocate. And we'll see both of you at TEDx RVA.
Slamming.
Show, we presented part one of a discussion on public art funding in Richmond. We talked to artist Ed Trask, who helped to present last year's Street Art Festival, and Anthony Harris of RVA Magazine. Harris, who organized last year's G40 Art Summit, has written a commentary piece on the magazine's website that asks some pointed questions about the city's public art commission and how Richmond allocates its limited public art money. This week, as part two of our discussion, we're joined by Doug Dunlap, who's a deputy director in the city's Department of Planning and Development Review. He helps to oversee the city's Public Art Commission and is a non-voting commission member. And City Councilman John Beliles, who assisted in bringing the Street Art Festival to Richmond last year. And a funny thing happened a few days after this interview, which was taped last week. The mayor's office has now proposed $3.3 million in additional public art money in the mayor's capital improvement budget for fiscal years 2015 and 2016. It appears to be a total in addition to the $1.1 million already earmarked for Richmond's new Justice Center. Considering the past spending on public art, this is unprecedented. What's uncertain at Showtime is how these funds will be used and whether or not they will be overseen by the Public Art Commission. One thing's for sure, we'll keep following this story. But first, our conversation with City Councilman John Beliles and City Deputy Director Doug Dunlap. I guess we'll start with the history of the Public Art Commission. When did it start, what are the goals of the Public Art Commission?
The Public Art Commission officially, the ordinance was actually adopted in 97, but I believe that previous to the adoption of the ordinance that 5 years prior, there was actually work that was going on. There was meetings and sort of orchestration and facilitating of projects by that group. And the ordinance in 97 really was adopted to give them the ability to strengthen the ability to grab the dollars or to obtain the resources of funding necessary to ensure that they could complete the projects. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, I would say that they had difficulty ensuring that they had necessary funding to complete projects. And so the ordinance gave them the ability to then ensure that those funds would be dedicated in each public improvement project involving a public building, a new public building, or a public open space that had a pedestrian orientation.
Mm-hmm. And it's based on some public art models in other states?
Yes, it is. There are other states that also have the program. And around the state of Virginia, there are probably 5 to 6 other localities that also have strong public art 1% programs mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Walk us through the process a little bit. This is a money that really can only be allocated in conjunction with capital projects. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. When we undertake a capital project, again, a line item is added to the budget specifically for public art. 1% is earmarked at that point. Mm-hmm. There are instances, again, where we sort of leave ourselves a little wiggle room and we won't encumber those funds at that point. Mm-hmm. Because if project costs actually run a little bit higher, then it gives us the ability to go back and pull additional funds specifically for public art.
Right.
Once we have a dollar amount and we are at a point where we're ready to move forward with a project, what happens is the Public Art Commission will then identify several members who will serve on a site selection team. Mm-hmm. That site selection team will then pull together other stakeholders. If the project is located in a neighborhood or in a specific location, then again, they will seek to identify stakeholders who will be impacted by the new art project or live in close proximity to the new art project, bring those individuals in, and also gather input from them on as they move through the process. Mm-hmm. The first step after establishing that selection, that site selection committee, is to then to do a call for artists. And in the past, we've done that in a manner that sort of mirrors a request for a proposal, mm-hmm. where the artists see that call. The call would
First of all, where does that call go out? How
we have a list of artists that we send information to through organizations. So it's far-reaching. We have artists that respond, not here just in the locality, but throughout the state and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of projects now where the artists who responded are from New York, I believe. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it is far-reaching, and through the years, we've had artists from around the country actually come in and complete pieces for us.
Mm-hmm.
The figure that's been kind of kicked around is $1.3 million. There seems to be a perception that there's $1.3 million out there ready to be dispersed in public art funds.
Right.
But it's not that simple. It's $1.3 million in conjunction with certain projects. Is that correct? Is that a correct figure?
Well, I believe that the figure is actually 1.1 million rather than 1.3. Right. 1.1 is what we have currently in the budget for the Justice Center project that would be dedicated for a public art project.
Mm-hmm. Why do we tie our public art funds to capital projects? Why wouldn't it be more a more open process so that you could put pieces of public art in other places besides the new buildings that are being constructed?
Well, we're actually not tied to having that project located on site. There have been instances where we have in the past completed projects associated with a new building or a new open space and have had the ability to look at other public spaces in close proximity where we could, where it might be more appropriate to locate the art piece.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about ex-Councilman Bruce Tyler's motion to limit the amount of public art funds. That was continued?
Yes,
and to this year, what's the status of that? Maybe we can bring John in on that as well.
The ordinance, the proposal, was introduced in January of 2012, just as the Justice Center construction was getting underway, and the line item money for the public art tied to that project was allocated and put in the budget. Since that has not passed, the city attorney has since informed us that even if that ordinance were to pass, it would not affect the money that's already been allocated.
It would affect then maybe the next project.
Right.
Yes.
And there are not – the Justice Center is probably the biggest capital project the city's ever going to undertake. It's very unlikely that you're going to see another allocation of $1.1 million because the city is probably not going to have a hundred plus million dollar capital project again.
Yeah.
So the couple of members of the commission, myself and Ms. Graziano, who was a co-sponsor of Mr. Tyler's paper, are going to get together later in March to discuss.
Mm-hmm. I remember there was some great outrage, like people were suddenly discovering that there was this stipulation for public art. Oh my gosh, look at all the taxpayer money we're spending.
Well,
but it's really not that much, is it? I mean,
when you're talking about, for instance, something. If you look at Paul DiPasquale's statue of Neptune in Virginia Beach, that cost about a little over $1 million. Mm-hmm. And that has become not only a symbol of Virginia Beach, it's the center point of the oceanfront. And, I mean, it's so popular now, the Virginia Tourism Corporation puts it on their cover.
I just did an article on Virginia Beach where I spoke to a bunch of city officials, and they all mentioned Neptune.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a landmark piece, and it, you know, things like that are not inexpensive. However, as Doug said, you know, the money for this project doesn't mean, and there was a misconception of this in a media story, doesn't mean that the money is going to hang Picasso's inside the Justice Center. I mean, this is a project that could occur somewhere in Chaco near the Justice Center, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's public art at the location.
Right.
So the ordinance is, you know, we're going to discuss the ordinance either raising the cap, which I think is a possibility, or whether we're going to go ahead and take a vote on it at the full council.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know that when I spoke with the mayor last year, he almost started the conversation about how important public art is, and I hope that maybe you can speak to that. What would you say are some of our most important pieces of public art that we have now that maybe people aren't aware of?
One of our most important pieces is a hanging piece of public art. It's called Skyrider. It's located just in front of Main Street Station, and that project serves sort of as an example of a collaboration between City of Richmond, State, where we were able to take the funding that we had available for the project and actually grow the project by partnering and collaborating with other institutions, entities, to attract additional dollars so that we could do a project of scale. That's one of the things that, you know, I think about as we talk about the amount of dollars that would be tied to this particular project. I mean, in comparison, when we look at the funding that has been spent on projects that we've done in the last few years here in the City of Richmond, and you compare that to funding that has been spent by other localities around the state,
right?
And in a sense, the City of Richmond sort of falls behind, lags behind the others. But this will give us an opportunity to begin to gain some ground and to actually complete a project of scale.
Because you're going to check on this figure for me, but I had $889,104 spent on 39 public art projects since 1993.
Right.
That's not even worth one Paul DePasquale Neptune, right?
Right.
Well, it does go, but because it's tied to capital projects, the funding is limited. For instance, the most recent piece that I believe will be installed this spring is the one associated with the new fire station on Sims Avenue.
Okay.
And that fire station, the budget, I believe, was 70-some thousand, even though the project cost more than a lot of the project was paid for with stimulus money. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't allocate the 1%. It was just the city matching funds that allocated the 1%. So
right.
That budget was smaller than the whole project. So tying it to capital projects, it is a legacy of the program that was started in the 90s. You know, now's the time, I think, for discussion. And I've had it with Paul, and Paul's discussed it with other members of the commission to look at doing something different, not necessarily tying it to capital projects. But that's a decision the commission would have to make, and then we would amend the ordinance if we wanted to change that program.
Right. Which, and these don't apply, this rule about public art being tied to capital projects doesn't apply to schools, right? School construction.
Correct.
You don't have that component when you build a school, right?
That's correct.
Well, that begs the question, where better to have public art than in a school? Why would you have that rule?
I agree. And again, that goes back to the legacy of that's the way they wrote the ordinance in the 90s, and it can be changed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, we have to talk about it and do it if we want to. Or do we want to change the whole program and not tie it to capital projects at all?
Mm-hmm.
It's 2013. There's ways now, you know. I think a lot of it is public art means something completely different today than it did in the early 90s and mid-90s when this was written. So,
explain. Well, what do you mean by that? I think I know what you mean, but what?
Well, 1% was kind of the in-fashion thing to do that a lot of municipalities did across the state and across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen a lot of cities, for instance, they have taken, I believe in Philadelphia, they don't have a percent from capital projects. They have, I think they have a 0.5%. I can't remember which city it is. There's one city that has 0.5% of their budget that goes to public art.
Wow.
And it's a more flexible, kind of fluid program that can change with the times because the money's there every year rather than just when you build something new.
Well, given the fact that we have the one of the most prominent art schools in the country, and given the fact that that art school is about to build a huge contemporary art institute, wouldn't it behoove us to, again, as you say, look at how we fund public art and see if we can't expand it? Or
absolutely. And in 1992 and 97, when this was actually put on the books officially, you know, we didn't have the best art school in the country, and now we do, and that's just a sign of the changing times. And you know what Ed and I did with the Street Art Festival last year, and what Tony and Shane did with G40, and what Vaughn Garland did with the Manchester Sculpture Walk a few years back. You remember that? That was kind of pioneering back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that are becoming more and more common in this city, where in the 90s, they just, you know, people mm-hmm. would give you a quizzical look if you said you were going to have a sculpture walk.
And we should say that the public art funds, that you can still find funding, apparently, with the city through the Economic Development Department. The Street Art Festival you helped put on did
yes,
that.
Right.
And also the G40 Arts Summit that Tony Harris helped put on.
Right. The city was very supportive of our efforts last year. And, you know, you look at some cities. I talked to a guy last May, right after the Street Art Festival, and he was in Toronto, and he was doing a documentary on the fact that Toronto mm-hmm. is actually kind of waging a war on street art. Mm-hmm. They don't want...
You're talking about murals and...
Murals yeah. and thing, you know, painting on buildings and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. Not graffiti. That's different.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have any part of it. And he was doing a documentary on it, and I reached out to him, and I said, well, if you ever want to, mm-hmm. you know, come to a city and do a documentary where a city is getting engaged, and they, you know, we can always do more, but, you know, the economy right now, times are tight.
Yeah.
It's amazing that the city can help us at all with funding. And,
right.
and you know, Ed and I were appreciative last year. I know Shane and Tony were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if...
On the other hand, there are funds out there for economic development, and you could make a pretty